This is the first Sunday of our month-long Ango intensive practice period. And being here on Sundays, you're part of it. I'll be talking, and also with Toan and Nyozen, about the text that we're studying throughout. And then there's Monday afternoon evenings and Wednesdays, and we had Sesshin for 2 days, and there'll be a practice day at the end. So people are participating in different ways. And I always pick some kind of pithy text for the Ango. And this year I went back to a very favorite and very important text. It's called Bendowa in the original Japanese, which means the wholehearted way, or the whole talk on wholehearted investigation of the way. It's most sort of literal translation. This was one of the most important pieces that Dogen Zenji wrote. When Dogen went to China in 1220, I think it was 3, as a young man, having trained as a Buddhist monk in Japan, Zen was just beginning to filter in. And there wasn't anyone who really had a deep understanding, no one who had really trained in Zen under a teacher, because the teachers were all in China. And so he went to China with his teacher. And he came back 4 years later, his teacher died there. And he came back, and within the next few years, before he developed his monastery and his training for his own monks, he wrote some things, but the two things he wrote that were real foundational pieces for his whole teaching and all of the Zen that has followed down to today in the Soto tradition, he wrote what's called Fukan Zazengi, which is instructions on Zazen. And he wrote this Bendowa, which is about the meaning of that practice of Zazen. So the practice of Zazen that he described in his Fukan Zazengi, in his instructions, is what we now call just sitting, this wholeheartedly putting yourself right here and now in the middle of your life, in the middle of life. And it's a very inclusive and extensive view of something that you're doing in a very immediate and personal way. So there are the instructions, and this is the piece that talks about the meaning of that kind of Zazen. And I talked about it on one day of Sesshin, and I'm going to, in some extent, repeat what I said, refining and adding to it. Only a few of you were here then, and none of us take it all in at any one time anyway. So this piece, talk on the wholehearted investigation of the way, is about how you and your individual practice at its core, the central you we sometimes call original face or original self, takes its place in this world, in the universe. So it's your practice and the world's practice meeting. The Bendowa, Ben is this intensive sort of wholehearted investigation. Do is the way, and Wa is a talk on it. So this Do, this way, is critical. When Dogen was kind of reshaping or giving a new, turning the wheel, we keep reshaping, and we are reshaping it again. So we're taking what we understand from him and pouring it into a new vessel called our lives at this time, receiving it and changing it. So he reshaped what was meant by the way, and then we reshape it in our own lives again. The kanji, or character for the way from China and Japan, has two parts. One is a wiggly little road, nice little country road, looks like. And the other is the self, most especially the face of the self. So your face is you facing in a direction. We face a direction and walk. That's the basic meaning of the way. It's never something outside you. And so we say, oh, the Buddha way sounds like some big thing out there somewhere. your face directed, orienting, and this body moving. That's the way. And this, as I realized, and I said Friday, that to have an orientation or direction and action means velocity. I think I learned this in high school physics, that velocity is not just speed or motion, but it's with a sense of direction. And so this means energetically going in a direction. That's the meaning of way. Now, there are many ways. There are many kinds of energetically going in a direction. In any energetically going in a direction, you have to choose. You have to make choices. Because we don't have unlimited energy. This body cannot go in every direction. It's wonderful to have a body. With this body, you can live and breathe and smell the flowers and feel the wind on your face, think, love, practice, all of this you can do because you have a body. And this wonderful body comes at a high price. First it hurts, and it gets sick, and then it dies. In the meantime, aside from being sick and hurting and dying and things like that, on a daily basis, on a moment-to-moment basis, one body can only go in really one direction at a time. You can sort of do two things while you're going in one direction. You kind of tend to waver, that multitasking thing. But basically, this body can self, has to make choices over and over and over of how to go forward, where to go. A few years ago, we used to study a poem in Ango that was that started out saying that that you know the practice is to drop your preferences, stop making all these choices. A moment's difference and heaven and hell are set apart. Well, actually, at the same time, you have to make choices all the time. It would be really irresponsible, not taking care of yourself or others or anything, to not make choices. So how do you make choices? So this high price that this body can only go in one direction at one time also has a great benefit. This choosing, having to choose, comes out of our values and deepens our values. If you notice that you're getting blundering around and getting bruised, it's because our values at that time aren't clear. The reasons why we're doing what we're doing in our life aren't clear. Our values are muddy or unheeded. So the way, any way, well, a big way, has turning, facing, has going with energy, and it has choice of a direction based on your values. It's very painful sometimes to choose one thing instead of another. And yet, if you don't, you make another kind of choice, the waffle choice. When Zen speaks of the way, it means the Buddha way. There are plenty of other ways. It is always the Buddha way it is speaking of, which says it already declares the core values right up front, of awakening, that's what Buddha is, that's what it means, and expressing that awakening, living in terms of it, having values then in accord or consistent with this Buddha, which is to say, awakening to a reality of impermanence and interdependence. So it's taking the energy to go in a direction and making value choices that emerge out of these very basic functions of the natural universe, of cause and effect. So it's a way of awakening to the totality of life, a way for an individual person to negotiate, that's another translation of it, negotiating the way, to negotiate negotiate those choices, problems, and opportunities of life in the widest terms. the widest terms I know of and the most deep and universal terms. The reason this is called universe, not that everyone should be a Buddhist, is that the terms, the foundation of this way and its values are that this is a cause and effect universe, a natural universe. And a cause and effect universe is a universe of endless movement, coming and going, of impermanence, of each thing made out of the others. Oh, that also means not only impermanent, but made of each other, that's interdependence. Out of that basic universal nature of things, the Buddha way guides a way to build values and choices in a personal life. So it's building a human life on this deep, natural substrate of life, which is why it can keep evolving and come into the 21st century now and be fresh and reinventable. The way has no preset borders. It doesn't mean anything goes, and certainly not wishy-washy. There are many guideposts, there are many directions, there are many choices, there are many texts, there are many teachers, there are many teachings, there are many schools. There are many choices, but there's no one official edge. You're in or you're out. It's inclusive. It's always open. At every moment is the opening to come in and to practice in this way. So it's really hard to be a fundamentalist Buddhist. People do it. The human mind is amazing, and we can do it. But it's hard. It doesn't lend itself to it. What happens then, the way that happens, is that people, and it's always a something to watch out for, is that there are Buddhists who say, this one text, this one sutra, is the true sutra and no other. You know, now it makes it clear, you know, but that's about the only way to be a fundamentalist Buddhist is to create preset borders by saying this and not that. But that is, for most schools of Buddhism, the antithesis of the Buddha way, which says more not this and not that. Don't choose one thing as a rigid right choice, and yet you have to make choices all the time. So no preset borders in the Buddha way. No one's excluded. That's the corollary there. And it has no beginning and no end. Having a beginning and an end, like having preset borders, would seem to make things clearer. You could start here and go there. But that would actually, in the end, be limiting and frustrating and exhausting. So at any moment, at every moment, we enter the way of waking up to our real life and finding a way out of that to go forward. That's why great traditional Zen saying that the way opens as you walk. It doesn't pre-exist even. There's no pre-existing thing. There's no one path. And yet, the way is there as you walk, because you take your whole life and what you understand and what you don't understand and your companions on the way and all your mistakes, and you take a step, the best step you can, and the way opens as you walk. There's the other saying that says Zen is a lifetime of mistakes, so they go together. The Buddha way is described in this Bendowa, this wholehearted way, as a true gate to reality, a true gate to the reality of your life, a true gate to the reality of life. True here means beyond comparison. Doesn't say true versus untrue. It's not this one is true and another one is false. It's this is true. It's like unique. I still get upset. The editor in me gets upset when people say something is more unique than something else. It doesn't work. It doesn't compute. Unique means just one of its kind. It may have qualities that we don't like or do like, but it is unique. It is itself. And in the same way, this is the Buddha way. It's not simply unique. It is, but in a comparable way, it is a true gate, because it is a gate open to all into a true understanding of self and other, always testable, always to be changed, and for the way to be changed and for us to be changed by it. A true gate to reality. We can't be true, real, just by going through life and having the fur rubbed off us. Those of us who know and treasure the Velveteen Rabbit know that the toys are talking. And the Velveteen Rabbit, one of the others, maybe it's the horse who says, one of them says that you get to be real. How do you get to be real? I really want to be real. I don't want to just be a toy. You get to be real when you've lived and the kids have lived you so hard that all the fur is rubbed off and you're kind of shabby. Then you're real. I remember that as a great moment in reading children's books. I still read children's books. But we can't, how do we get the fur rubbed? We can't just do that. We can't, we have to use our entire body and mind to figure out how to best go forward and meet life moment after moment. The Buddha way is a true or complete way about being real. There's no rule book on marriage or child rearing or jobs. And yet, there's the way can guide us to formulate our specific life, ways to go through our specific life in terms of the world's truths and not just its habits and its lies. And through our own life, not just in terms of our habits and our sort of convenient lies to ourselves and omissions. So in trying to find a way to describe that, a way to aim at this completion or wholeness, the meaning of, and it will be described in this text, is wholeheartedness, a central characteristic. Not holding back, putting yourself completely into what you're doing, and making some real careful assessment of what it is you're doing. So to do just anything wholeheartedly, fully, throw yourself into whatever you're doing in itself isn't it. We flop around a lot that way in our lives. We bounce in something and bounce out again. That's not it. But there is this quality of being wholehearted, of not holding back. And this way, this Buddha way, is wholehearted, but it does not say it's the only way or that some others are not wholehearted. It's very important to let things be have a full, complete statement and not take them in that kind of either-or way that our mind and ear tend to have been trained into. The way of tea, the way of flower arranging, the way of judo or karate, the way of raising children, the way of making functional pottery. Putting your whole life into an endeavor doesn't mean you don't do something else either. Wholeheartedly doing something important that has aim and shape and direction will take you a very long way. And the only difference between the Buddha way and these other ways is that there's no product, there's no thing to focus on. It is the doing itself. Your life is the pot in this case. And so it's very useful for potters and family makers to do this practice. And so the wholeheartedness is a kind of embrace. Embracing this moment, embracing your full self and those of others, being accountable to embrace something, you are accountable for yourself and others. If I embrace someone, I step on their toe, I'm accountable for the fact that I've just stepped on their toe. I meant well, and they may have liked it too, but they didn't like the part where I stepped on their toe, and I have to take that into account. We can't say, but I meant well. Sure, I meant well, and I stepped on their toe. More likely hurt their feelings than stepped on their toe. That's the more common. But metaphorically, there we are. It is an embracing. When Uchiyama Roshi said, Zen is, and Zazen is, everything you encounter is your life. Well, please embrace your life. And that means in some appropriate way, embracing everything you encounter. It doesn't mean rushing up and hugging everyone. What is the appropriate way to embrace what is right here? Appropriate for you and appropriate for them, appropriate for this relationship. Everything is relationship. Wholeheartedness is a kind of surrender. As you know, to embrace something, you have to surrender something. We surrender. You surrender. You do not surrender yourself in this practice. You do not give yourself up. You essentially surrender to yourself, not to the self of gain and loss. That essentially, you might want to surrender that one temporarily. That's one of the ways that Zazen could be described, is temporarily surrendering the air traffic controller who's up there directing. And in this practice, we never surrender to another person. Surrender is a matter of opening, and so that you can meet and embrace. When we're closed, we can't. Surrender is an opening. And we do this in Zazen, and we did it especially in Sesshin. That's one of the beauties of Sesshin. It's scary for that reason, not really because of so many hours of sitting, but because people correctly understand that it has something to do with surrender. Because once you get there, you've surrendered your day and what you're going to do in that day and how you're going to do it. The bell rings, sit down. The bell rings, get up. The bell rings, breakfast. You will have breakfast and you will have a chance to stretch your legs. You will be taken care of, but there is a surrendering the way our usual control over our life. That is one of the most valuable aspects. And then that you, when you do it, you're doing it with other people. I once sat Sesshin alone. I was holding the seat of a Zendo's Sangha doing it. I don't like sitting Sesshin alone. Sesshin is primarily collecting our minds in each other. We work with each other. We're supported by each other in this surrender. And it's very intimate. All that silence, it's in the midst of that silence, we're very revealed to ourselves and each other. And every period of Zazen you do, not just in Sesshin. In every period of Zazen, you surrender your will, and then it picks back up, and you surrender it, and it picks back up. You do this back and forth and back and forth. Opening the hand of thought is surrendering the thinking mind's preeminence, dominance, and it zings back in and takes it back. When you surrender that controlling mind, you get to be you on different terms. You don't give up being you, and that's, of course, what we discover in Zazen. It's not only that the mind and our habits keep going anyway, despite our best efforts to let them loose for a little bit, but beyond that, there is a surrender, and you find of that grasping self and its agendas, it's a surrender of agenda, but you find you are there. You don't lose you, that more likely to actually find you. And the only way really to be changed by our experience is to be in a position to be willing and able to surrender some of our usual habits, ruts, walls, plans, agendas, knowledge, correctness, all of that, including our uncorrectness. You know, the I'm so bad I can't do this is just, it's another kind of similar kind of wall, just like the one that says I don't need this. sometimes it squeezes or pinches or feels, foreign. And often we're drawn to an eclectic spiritual practice as an alternative to a tradition that can sometimes feel cumbersome, because there's a lot of it. And it comes from all sorts of languages and cultures and different eras and has all these forms and all kinds of things of that sort. Right? We can take up an eclectic spiritual practice where we take a good practice from here and a good practice from there and another good practice from there and visit one teacher and another teacher. This can be very fine and lovely, and it can fit you very well. And that becomes one of its limitations. Not the good practices included, but the fact that it fits you so well because you chose it. What seems initially to be its advantage is, in fact, it's a big disadvantage, because what already fits you well with how you already are can't take you very far beyond where you already are. It can't even show you very far beyond where you are. And we need that. And that will sometimes be a great opening. Going beyond what I already know about myself. Please, yes, I'd like this. It'll be a great opening. And sometimes it is. And sometimes instead it feels like it rubs and it grates and the shoe pinches. Because it wasn't designed with us personally in mind. But it was designed with the human person in mind. And we get to expand what it is to be human. Us being human, individually. When we take on a tradition and a practice that has a deep foundation and a great breadth and some coherence. So the title says that it is about investigating the way. Now, or negotiating the way. Now, usually when we say investigate, we think in terms of analyzing or observing. And there are Buddhist practices, too, that involve an observing yourself. The Zen doesn't work. It's not in Zen. It's an examining from within, always participating. You always are the participating one. And from within that, you investigate. You investigate what it is to be you. You investigate what it is to be alive. At the beginning of entering the Buddha Way, for instance, you have to, in a way, examine from outside. You examine, you probe, you look into it. What is it? What is going on here? Is it safe? Is it appropriate? Well, I don't know if it's really going to be appropriate, but is it safe enough to start out? It's very important to take care of ourselves by investigating. Don't just jump in blindly. When you jump into something blindly, you're jumping into an illusory idea of whatever you're jumping into. And of course, this happens again and again in our practice, not just at the beginning. Shakyamuni said in an often quoted sutra, the early sutras are vignettes of his teaching life. And in this one, he's on the road wandering and teaching, and he goes to a place where people, and he preaches the Dharma and he teaches, and the people say, "Oh, wow, Lord, this is a wonderful teaching. This is really fine. But you know what? There was a teacher through 2 weeks ago and he sounded really good too. And what are we supposed to do? How do we choose? What do we do?" And he said, "Listen carefully and filter all whatever these different teachings are, mine and others, through your own experience, and then judge for yourself what is real, true, and productive, and go in that direction." Sifting. So this the investigating that goes through our entire practice in Zazen is investigating your life in this moment, but it's not observing. That's standing outside and looking in, and it's dualistic, and it feeds that whole dualistic apparatus of me here, you there, divided parts, that is the kind of suffering that Buddhism is trying to address. So the only thing really in this practice you can do if you find yourself observing is discover how much suffering you create for yourself by observing, how much you cut splitting yourself into parts. Instead, we look from the inside. So investigating in Zazen is primarily nonverbal. We don't only investigate with ratiocination, with a linear thinking process. Nonverbal investigating is like savoring. When you take a bite of something and you savor the flavors, you don't need to. You can also identify which spices are in there, but I'm hopeless at that, so I don't even try. What I'm doing is tasting the flavor. Maybe enjoying, maybe not enjoying. Tasting flavors within the flavor. Probing from inside your body mind, how your body mind is. It's of sensing. Sensing is investigating. We call this a body practice, Zazen, because you practice in your body, and one of the ways the body investigates is by sensing. Oh yeah. Right? And then we find ourselves upright again. We don't need to use words. So in the same way, you're doing Zazen and suddenly you wake up to the fact that you're off in La La Land having a conversation or an argument or something. You don't even need words at that point. You don't need to call yourself a dummy. You don't need to do that. You don't even need to say, now I'm going to return to silence. You don't need to go on with the words. Drop the words and return to maybe your gut, to most literally. The Zen has always valued the gut. That's to say, the tanden, the hara, the place down. It's ancient yogic views and now modern neurology say that there's a whole lot going on down here. There's a major neurological plexus down here, connecting with the one up here. And there's a lot of grounded energy here. So you return, you don't need to use words. That whole thing, the recognizing where you are suddenly out to lunch and returning, doesn't require words. And yet it is deeply investigating your life, more deeply than with words. So when in chanting and bowing, you inquire with body and mind. So there's an inquiry going on. In those days at Hokyoji, when I used to recite, this the text of this wholehearted way as a noon service during Sesshin. In those years, I counted something like 40 bows in the morning service. And I would be there bowing, full prostration, saying to myself, what is a nice atheist like me doing in a place like this, doing this thing? But I did it from within it. I inquired about bowing while bowing. It wasn't going to hurt me, so it wasn't a harmful practice, and I could inquire about what it was from inside. Otherwise, you're standing outside and you have only a very limited view of what it is. The inquiry in connection with Dharma teaching, a teisho, a text, is much more with the mind. The mind needs to be part of the inquiry. Would never want to not include it. And then, yes, comes a time for assessing and choosing, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Doing it in the context of Zen practice, where there's no thing you are choosing over another thing, you're returning to the center of your life, there's no product at all, it's one of the ways in which this is a very clear practice for your life. It's clear, you get to see what the whole activity of inquiry is, because there's no product. And then you can take that all that understanding of inquiry out to all the other activities and other ways of your life, where there is an object, and it is, frankly, more complicated. So you investigate and examine and decide that right now, at this moment, it is safe and appropriate to sit down and do Zazen, or it is safe and appropriate to bow, or it is safe and appropriate to come hear a Dharma talk. Or you want to investigate so as to verify for yourself that it is appropriate for your life to do this thing, whatever this thing is. And we need criteria for embracing a path or a person, for surrendering some of our well-honed controls, boundaries, and walls. What makes it safe or appropriate to surrender some of your controls? Working it out in this practice is, again, a paradigm for working it out, expressing it in the rest of your life. Is this activity, practice, person trustworthy? See, that's one of the first, one of the important. Not trust me. I won't come in here ever and say, trust me. If I do, do something about me. See, that's the other thing. If you want to preserve the wholeness, the wholesomeness of this, and I come in and sit down one day and say, trust me, you say, Jisho, you must be out of your mind. Can we help you? Something. You might try to be kind about it, but you would want to do something because it's in your interest as much as mine to preserve the wholesomeness of what we have. And I can't guarantee not to veer off. But I will do my best to guarantee to listen and to try to see what I'm not doing, that is what I'm doing that's not trustworthy. And to, because I seek to be trustworthy. None of us are 100% trustworthy. We're humans. We wander and we deceive ourselves and we get strange ideas. But we can aim to be trustworthy. This practice is a true companion because the practice itself aims to be trustworthy and aims to help me be trustworthy. It doesn't try to take me out to being something else. What are the criteria? Does this path or person or activity support you being fully you? We hardly even know what is most fully us. This practice is about that. Supports you finding out, endlessly, what it is to be most fully yourself, or yourself most fully human, most completely, fulfilling your humanity. Or does it have an agenda? Does this person, path, practice, want you to flower and be the best person you can be? Or does it want you to be what is best for them or for it? Does it help you find your ground, or does it whisk you off your ground? We don't need to be whisked away. We don't need to be liberated from ourselves. We more need to be liberated into ourselves, our inclusive self. So we do this practice that is over and over and over again, saying, "Well, what self are you embracing? What self are you surrendering to? What self are you bringing forward? Who is this?" And without being a dualistic about it, saying, "Is this self and not that self?" We don't throw away our most personal, daily, ordinary self. It is not wrong to have. That's why I don't like the language that Uchiyama Roshi's translators used of small self and big self. Personal self, indeed, the personal self sometimes gets narrow, but it is also wide and deep. And it is, but the conscious mind, our conscious mind, is not who we are and is not our personal self, but it sure gives us to understand that. That whatever we're currently thinking and feeling, and who we think we are, that's what we think our self, our personal, or our real self is. And that's maybe 5%. But how much we're not aware of that we already know, that's already in our self that we have known and lived, that we're not aware of at any one moment. Is it not part of ourself? Yes, it is, but it's not here and now to be drawn on. And then you have then it comes up when a lot of it, not all of it. When you need it, when you call on it. So there's a great deal of unconscious person. And history, your body, what you ate for lunch, your neurological system. All these are the self, yourself operating here and now. Relationships. The personal self we are is not only made of what it is made of all of the encounters of our entire life. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. It is formed in the crucible of relationship, and it is expressed in the crucible of relationship. So our relationships are not separate from our personal self. Being a living being in the web of living beings is not separate from our personal self. From the air we breathe and the lunch we eat, to everything about what we take in and what we give out, and just the fact of our being here on this planet together. But our personal self tends to be of this dualistic sort that says, I'm here and you're there. This is me. I have a name. I have an address. I have habits and preferences. And I will meet you across our differences. That's generally the view of the personal self. But behind that, what we call this original face that looks out from behind the particular wallpaper at our world from inside us, that we may call original face or original self. I meet others through their differences, and behind that, what we have in common. If we only met across our differences, we wouldn't speak enough of the same language to make sense to each other. Our original self, that questing, what is it to be me? How will I do this? How will I most truly go forward and encounter what I encounter? Is meeting another true being doing the same thing. And we remind each other of that. How could we remind each other of that kind of deep quest, except that we both, that is where we are, the same. And we meet through that dynamic. This original self is the self that connects intimately with that same selfness of other beings. Now, if you have a child, you have a sense of that through the shared DNA or through the shared endless long lifetime from infancy or from whenever you enter and become the parent to that child. It doesn't have to start with gestation to be a parent, to have a deep, intimate relationship like that. It's harder for us to really know that intimacy with even a partner in marriage, let alone another animal, let alone a tree or a rock or the air and the earth. But to understand that there is a true original self in every being and that they are all expressing in occluded or clearer languages that urge to express their original true self, and that there is a connection that we can meet across because everything is expressing that. That is the message of this wholehearted way. That is this or an original self, original true nature, is embedded in all that we are and all that we do. And it's hard for us to speak the language of stones. We have with each other as people very beautiful, complex languages. We very finely articulated. And we still don't understand each other. The very complication sometimes makes it harder, not easier. But that's our job. Using not only, not just it's something that's inarticulate, but articulate in all the different ways, with and without words, to find, express our truth and to meet others and find others doing the same thing. So the wholehearted way means encountering each thing, each event, each being as our life itself, because it is, with full care and attention. Or it means, for a human being, going in that direction. I'm wholeheartedly going in the direction of being like that. I'm not like that. But I'm wholeheartedly, when it means whenever I remember, I put as much of my heart as I can find at that moment into waking up to being this kind of person and continuing on. And Zazen, I find, is the most direct route back to remembering that person and that voice inside that knows that this is my direction. And without Zazen, I don't know how I would hear that rather quiet voice inside and outside, the same inside and outside voice whispering about truth and whispering about beauty. So I guess our life is a life of stumbling along the way. Right? Discarding illusions about how it ought to be. And continuing to stumble along the way, saying, oh, that must be the human way to do it, or my human way to do it. Stumbling along the way with both feet. So this is, might say, my way of saying what I hear Dogen saying when he talks about the wholehearted way.